Due at the end of the class, probably I'll have you give a presentation describing your results, or what you learned anyway. And the idea will be that you'll read two or three papers on some topic related to quantum error correction or fault tolerance, and write up something describing results of those papers. And then, like I said, probably have to give a presentation on that. If we had this many people actually taking the class for credit, or some significant fraction of this, then I may have to rethink that plan of having a presentation. But I'm guessing, since there's only something like six people registered, that a lot of you have not definitively decided to take it for credit. Let's see. But I don't think I have enough copies of these things for everybody. But my plan, this is a three-hour lecture that's kind of long, is that we'll go roughly an hour and a half, take a break, and then go to rest. So I can maybe print out a couple more copies if we need some at that break. Let's see. Other basic material. Well, so this is a class on quantum error correction and fault tolerance. My intent is that this should be designed for people who've taken an introductory course on quantum computing, like one of the courses at the university at Waterloo. It's not impossible you'll be able to understand it without that, but since I'll be assuming some basic stuff about quantum circuits and density matrices and things like that, it might be a little hard if you don't know that sort of thing. On the other hand, I'm not assuming that you know anything about classical error correcting codes, although that's one of the questions I ask on a questionnaire. It's certainly not going to hurt if you know that. If you're not going to need to know too much, and what you'll need to know, I'll tell you. But of course, it's helpful to have familiarity with ideas once before you see them the second time. Okay, any questions on that kind of basic stuff? Yeah, so the other thing is that this course is going to be recorded, so that the Perimeter Institute website will have recordings of basically all the lectures, hopefully. So if you hear a little bit of whirring during the lecture, it's one of the cameras up there tracking me. So, hi, Mom. It's conceivable she may actually watch this, or at least the beginning part. So I have to be careful. So that's a lesson to all of you, in fact. If anything you put on the internet, I don't know if the NSA is going to look at it, but certainly your mother might. So. Okay. So if second chance to ask questions about the administrative part of the course. Okay. So in that case, maybe I'll start on the scientific part. So the very first thing I'm going to do is teach you, since the goal is to teach you about quantum error correction, seems that the first thing to do is to know your enemy. So in other words, I want to tell you about errors. So what are the kinds of errors we have to worry about in a quantum computer, or in just quantum communication, in fact? For the first part of the course, quantum error correction, we're going to be not so much thinking about doing quantum gates, but just protecting against errors in a state that's been sitting around. So for instance, we might be storing it in memory, we might be sending it over quantum communication channel. And the usual formalism to describe that is, so we have some quantum state. Which we could write as a density matrix in general. And the most general type of evolution we can have, if we take such a state, it interacts with an environment which initially has no correlation or entanglement with the quantum state. And then we wait some time, interact with the most general possible operation. And then we wait some time, and then take the quantum state again. Well, the most general thing that can happen is the quantum state rho could go to some function S of rho, where S of rho is a linear map. So this is the new density matrix, S of rho. S is a linear map with a number of additional properties. First of all, it's positive. Density matrices, you remember, have always positive eigenvalues, they're positive matrices. And so S should have the property that preserves that, because the state you want to get out at the end should, again, be a density matrix. It should be trace preserving. And that's because the trace of a density, actually, maybe why don't I write these properties about density matrices? So, rho is positive. And when I say positive, I mean, of course, positive semi-definite. It could have zero eigenvalues. And trace rho is equal to, it's equal to 1. And so it should be trace preserving, so that trace of S of rho should also be 1. Again, so that S of rho is a density matrix. And finally, the most non-trivial condition is that it should be what's called completely positive. And so completely positive just says that it remains positive even if you're doing this map on part of entangled state. So S is completely positive if the map S tensor I is positive. Okay? Again, if you've taken one of the introductory quantum computing classes, I hope you've seen this before, but it's good to remind you. And in fact, you won't actually need most of this more advanced stuff about density matrices and completely positive maps very often in this class, only occasionally. And unfortunately, most of that occasionally will be today. If you're not familiar with that stuff, but only know pure states, you can probably pick your way through and figure out the important points, which aren't really going to depend on that. Some of the proofs may, and some of the motivation may. And I guess some of the problems may, unfortunately. But then you can ask for help. Okay. So the thing about these properties is, as I said, they're necessary for a quantum operation. But in fact, they're also sufficient. So any map that has these properties can be, in principle, performed as a quantum operation. Of course, doing this in practice on some particular experimental system, that's very difficult. But that's a story for a totally different class. Okay, and so one of the main theorems about such maps so normally we kind of omit the linear and positive parts, which are kind of trivial, and just say completely positive trace preserving as the more interesting properties of this map. So it's if and only if. So S is completely positive trace preserving map, if and only if we can write it in this form. And so these AKs are the Krauss operators. And this is the Krauss representation of a completely positive. Yeah?
Is it true in infinite dimension?
In infinite dimension. I think so, but I'm not sure. I don't know too much about infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. In any case, pretty sure during this class we'll be dealing with finite dimensional spaces. Yeah, I mean, there's been a couple of things done related to quantum reflection that use like continuous variable Hilbert spaces, but I mean, unless you choose that for your project, I don't think we'll get to that. Other questions? Okay. So now my first big challenge, getting down this board. So this is just general formalism. And the point of setting that up is to introduce some common types of errors you're likely to encounter in everyday life, or at least everyday life if you're doing quantum computing. Somehow people on the street don't encounter these types of errors. Or maybe they do, but they don't know. Fine distinction. So know your enemy. So in this context, of at least of quantum errors, that type of CP-GP map is sometimes called a quantum channel. Or more often, I'll just call it an error. We use other CPT maps, of course. I mean, when we do quantum error correction, the error corrector procedure itself is going to have to be a quantum operation, and therefore we'll have to satisfy it. But right now, I'm just introducing some things that are going to look like errors. So what's a good example? Well, here's a very simple one. We could just do a unitary rotation of the state, right? So rho would go to u rho u dash. Right, that's what happens if we take a state psi and map it to u psi. Since rho is psi psi like that, then it goes to u rho u dagger. Okay? That's a very simple map. But it's still very interesting. And there's a lot of different possibilities for what u could be. So for instance, we might think of u as a bit flip. So let's now consider a bunch of examples on a two-dimensional Hilbert space, a qubit. So we could have u is a bit flip, which takes 0 to 1, 1 to 0. We'll call that x. You could write it as a matrix. Another possibility is perhaps a little more interesting. It's more of a quantum thing. We could have a phase flip. This one we're going to call z. And so z is going to take 0 to 0, but 1 is going to go to minus 1. By the way, if I write over here, can people on the left-hand side see that still? OK, good. And people in the back, if I'm writing too small, let me know that too. People on the web, if I'm writing too small, you're out of luck. And of course, we can write z as a matrix also. And it's just a diagonal matrix, but it has a minus 1. A 1 and a minus 1, so it's a non-trivial type of thing. I guess while I'm doing this, we could also put in the identity, also known as no error. Another thing we could do is we could have do a bit flip and then a phase. And I'm going to throw in an extra factor of I, so I'm going to define y is equal to ixz. So I guess actually that's a phase flip and then a bit flip. And if you write that as a matrix, that's this. And I threw in the factor of I to make it Hermitian. So now y squared is to 1. And x, y, and z are nice matrices. They're called the Pauli matrices. So they have these nice properties. Like I said, y squared is to 1, but so to x squared and y squared. But also, they anti-commute with each other. So x, y is equal to minus y, x. And similarly for the other pairs. Okay, so those are some pretty simple errors. Let's stay unitary, but look at something more exciting. So let's define phase rotation. And it could be rotation by any angle. So now we have an infinite set of possible errors that we're talking about. I'm going to call this r theta. And r theta is going to be defined by this matrix. Along the diagonal, it'll rotate a 0 by phase e to the minus I theta, and a 1 by phase e to the plus I theta. But of course, global phase doesn't have any physical meaning in quantum mechanics. You have to be careful it's really a global phase. But if it is, then it doesn't mean anything. So we could rewrite this. We could take out that global phase explicitly and rewrite this as this. And you'll probably see, you'll sometimes see one of these, either of these two forms, but it's the same operation. Okay? The difference is you have to be a little careful because this has a factor of 2 in it. But I'm defining it with the theta here. Okay? So those are possible unitary operations. Good? Okay, so another class of possible, completely positive trait preserving maps, possible quantum channels, is if we take some CPTV maps that we already have and take a convex mixture of them, right? We can say with one probability we'll do one thing, with a different probability we'll do something else. Certainly you can do that physically, right? You could flip a coin and, depending on the outcome of the coin, do one or the other thing. So let's write down a bunch of examples like that. So for instance, we could have the dephasing channel. And the dephasing channel is defined so that rho gets mapped to itself with probability 1 minus p. And with probability p, it gets a phase flip. Remember how to make the p and the rho more distinct, unfortunately. And that's going to be endemic throughout this Blackboard program. With probability 1 minus p, we get no error. And with probability p, we get phase flip. And this type of channel is actually very common in a lot of experimental systems. You'll see if you create a superposition, it'll kind of gradually decay over time into a mixture, right? And that's due to phase damping. And it's since it's frequently called frequently people cite a T2 time for dephasing. I'm not sure exactly how it's defined. But basically, 1 minus p looks like something of this form. If you wait for time t, then the probability of a phase error, or the probability of not having a phase error, decreases exponentially. And the time constant gamma is something like 1 over t2. But there might be some factor of 2 or something like that. Okay? One way you can understand this type of channel is the environment kind of slowly gaining information about the system. And that's why it's such a very common thing. Okay, what else? Well, why stick to just phase flips? We could have other kinds of poly errors also. Did I say poly error? Yes. The next type of error we'll consider, the next type of channel, is the depolarizing channel. This one is not so common in experiments, but it's very beloved of theorists because it has very nice symmetries. So in this case, the map is, well, again, with a probability 1 minus p, we're going to do nothing. And then with a probability p, we're going to have some error, which is going to be equally likely to be an x, y, or z error. So what does that mean? Well, that's probably p over 3 that we have a bit flip error, plus probably p over 3 that we have a y error, plus probably p over 3 that we have a z error. Okay? So as you may be beginning to tell, I kind of like the poly matrices for reasons that will become increasingly obvious over the course of this lecture and the next one. Okay, so are people happy with this panel? So one of the interesting things about this Krauss representation is that it's not unique, in fact. And if there's a unitary, yes, if you have a unitary operation, then that is the unique Krauss representation, basically, aside for some kind of trivial things. In the case where you're mixing two really different things, where pure states will go to mixed states, it's never going to be unique. And so the polarizing channel has some very interesting alternate representations. So for instance, you can write it this way. Okay, so with probability 1 minus 4/3 p, we keep the original state. And with probability 4/3 p, we throw it away and replace it by a completely mixed state. It should not be I, it should be I over 2. We need that factor of 2 in order to have trace equals 1, right? Because 1, 1 has trace 2 for a qubit. This kind of looks a little funny when you compare it to this, right? This one, we're interpreting it as probably 1 minus p of no error, and with probably p of an error that could be equally likely x, y, or z. This one looks like it's probably 1 minus 4/3 p of no error, and then a 4/3 p probability of this totally randomized error. Why is that? Well, the thing is that the identity is a mixture of everything. And in particular, it's a mixture of the original state with other things. So for instance, we can write the identity, or at least the identity over 2, as 1 quarter times the identity plus 1 quarter. We want to specifically mix slightly less white. So it's 1 quarter times the original state plus 1 quarter x rho x plus 1 quarter y rho y plus 1 quarter z rho z. So if we take the original state and we do a random poly matrix, you get density x, y, or z with equal probabilities, then we get a uniformly mixed state. And so that's how you can convert from this form to this form. Okay? And in fact, there's something else you can do. Instead of saying, well, okay, so I like the poly matrices, but maybe you don't like them. Maybe you want, you know, general unitary matrices. Well, that's another thing you can do. This is also equal to the case where we average over all unitary matrices. And again, we have to take the 4/3 p. But now what we're going to do is we're going to, with probably 4/3 p, we're going to do some random unitary. So the integral over unitary group of u rho u dot. So it's maybe worth saying, it's maybe obvious, but maybe not. Why up here I was just writing x rho x, and here I have to write u rho u dagger. And the answer to that is very easy. It's just because x is Hermitian. I guess I didn't say that explicitly, but that's another property of these poly matrices, x, y, and z. They're all Hermitian, so x is equal to x dagger. Okay? So that's the polarizing time. We don't have to stop there. I mean, the polarizing kernel is nice and symmetric, but we could do something that's less symmetric. We could take the poly matrices, but with different probabilities. So we call that a general poly kernel. So the general poly kernel is, well, now there's separate probabilities for x, y, and z. So we have no error, only with probability 1 minus px minus py minus pz. And then probably px, we have an x. Probably py, we have a y. And then probability pz, we have a z. Okay? Simple and sensible. Okay, and so the last panel I wanted, this is again not incredibly common experimentally, but it's again something nice for theorists to consider. It's more general than the polarizing panel. So the last panel that I want to consider is kind of experimentally very common, and that's called the amplitude damping panel. So in this case, we have two cross operators in the usual representation. And a zero is going to be this matrix. And a one is going to be this matrix. Okay, so how do we understand this? Well, let's start with A1. That's relatively easy to understand. In A1, well, if we put in a 0, A1 will annihilate it. Right? And if we put in a 1, well, then we'll get a 0 state up. Okay, but the norm has changed, because now that only happens with amplitude gamma, so probability gamma squared. So the idea is that A1 will never happen when we have the zero state. But if we have the one state, it'll sometimes collapse down to zero. Okay? So what we can think of this is, for instance, in an atom, you have a ground and excited state. And the excited state will sometimes spontaneously emit a photon and go down to the ground state. Okay? Of course, this is a non-unitary map. But that's OK, because this is only part of a completely positive trace-preserving map. And if you put these together and calculate that formula, sum of ak dagger ak, you'll find that you do, in fact, get the identity. It's an easy thing to do. Okay. So what about this one? This one is much more subtle. Okay. So this, well, we need to have it in this form so that we have that relationship satisfied. But you'd think that if the atom doesn't emit a photon, if it doesn't relax and excite it to the ground state, well, why should it be changed at all? Right? You might naively think it should be the same. So A0 should be the identity. But that's not right. And the reason is this. It's because this doesn't do anything if the atom, this can never happen when the atom is already in the ground state. So by finding out that it hasn't emitted a photon, it now becomes more likely that the atom was in the ground state to start with. Okay? That's what this is saying. This is saying that it's, the zero state is more likely than it was before. And the one state is less, well, zero state is equally likely, and the one state is less likely. Okay? So what happens if you have a state that's partly ground and partly excited, well, sometimes there's going to be this big jump where it goes all the way to the ground state. But even if that doesn't happen, it slowly shifts to the ground state, because you find out by the fact that it hasn't emitted a photon that it was in the ground state to begin with. Kind of something weird quantum mechanical going on there. But, well, it can happen with probabilities too. But, you know, it comes out of the formulas of the mathematics of quantum mechanics. So anyway, this is, I mean, as you can maybe tell from the atom example, this is actually a pretty common type of thing experimentally. So it has another, you may have wondered why this was T2. This, of course, is T1. For this type of process. And again, it's the characteristic time scale. You'll get kind of this exponential decay of excited over ground. Okay? So those are the quantum panels I wanted to show you. Those are the qubit channels I want to show you. Now. So are there any questions on those? No? Okay. So maybe this is all too easy. Okay, so now let's go to channels that affect bigger systems. In particular, we're going to be very interested in this class in channels that affect composite systems. So for instance, we'll have the map S is going to map some tensor product of Hilbert spaces. So one thing I didn't mention before, but is true, is that a completely positive phase-preserving map doesn't have to have the same Hilbert space as the input and the output. It could, for instance, map you to a Hilbert space that's larger or smaller than that. And the reason for that is because it's the most general thing you could do. So for instance, you can just add extra qubits. That's a map that increases the dimension of the Hilbert space. Or you can throw some away. That's a map that decreases the dimension. And it's also true, though maybe I won't write it up, that those are the most general things you can do that will increase or decrease dimension. And that a general quantum operation, CP-GP map, can be represented by some combination of adding qubits, throwing away qubits, and a unitary operation. And I think I will actually use that fact later today. Okay. So in general, we might have this quantum operation that maps some tensor product of Hilbert spaces and different Hilbert spaces into another tensor product of Hilbert spaces. And most of the time, I'll just be considering the case where they're the same. But like I said, for the moment, let's let them maybe be different. And so one very common situation is, depending on the context, sometimes called independent channel or errors. Independent. Or sometimes memoryless. And that's just the case where it's doing something separate on each of those tensor factors. So S is equal to a tensor product itself, S1, tensor, S2, etc. Where S sub I maps H sub I to H sub I prime. Okay? That's pretty straightforward. And of course, like most people in quantum computing, we work a lot with qubits. So that's a very common thing we're going to consider. We're going to consider the case where these are qubits, and these are also qubits. And so the SIs are qubit maps. So for instance, they might be any of the maps above or over there. And then S is a tensor product of independent qubit maps. Okay? So now we've got another huge class of possible operations. But we don't have to do that. And in fact, a lot of the time in this class, we'll be considering something that's not technically independent, although it's closely related. So we're going to consider a t-qubit error. And so the t-qubit error is going to act on this n-qubit Hilbert space. But it's not going to act kind of on the whole, on all of the tensor factors. It's only going to act on t of them. And on the remaining t qubits, it might do anything. Okay. So one possibility, of course, is that we have something like this, an independent channel, where n minus t of these SI maps are the identity, and t of them are not. But we don't have to consider that. It could be something that takes those t qubits and does some horrible entangled thing to them. And so there's, depending on the context again, you might use this phrase in a little bit, slightly different way. Remember I said that we can take any CPT map and take a convex combination of them, any different ones, and take a convex combination of them, and still get a CPT map. Well, that's what we do here. If we take any t-qubit error maps and take a convex combination of them, we'll still get something that's considered a t-qubit error. Okay? So, yeah?
You seem to be restricting attention to qubits and Hilbert spaces that are, as I mentioned, that's a power of 2. Is there any reason for that?
There's a reason, but not a very good reason. So the bad reason is, well, it's just kind of convenient to deal mostly with qubits. But almost everything I'm going to show you is not dependent on that. So there's some kind of technical mathematical stuff. But most of these can work in cases where, well, okay, so I obviously haven't gotten to any kind of error correction stuff yet. But there are error correcting codes that work in things that are powers of different dimensions. In fact, on a problem set, you'll get something that's not even a tensor product, but still you can do some quantum error correction. In practice, again, it's helpful to have all these Hilbert spaces be the same size because, you know, you get nicer mathematical properties. But again, it's not really necessary. So certainly for what I'm doing so far, it's not necessary at all. For what I'll be doing later, it's kind of necessary. But really, you can relax most of those constraints even then. But it's nice to deal with something very definite. I should say that there are some significant differences when you go from qubits to higher dimensional states in the theory of quantum error correction. So specific codes, there might be analogs of them in different dimensions, but there might not be. So while the general theory has some similarities, specific codes don't necessarily carry over from one dimension to another. And we'll talk about that in much more detail later in the course. So, but mostly I want to know if people understand this definition of T-qubit error more or less, because it's maybe a little more subtle than the things I've been doing so far.
So when you take convex combinations, does it have to be actually the same T-qubits?
No. No, it doesn't. So that, of course, could get you something that acts on lots of different qubits. But the idea is, then it's a probabilistic mixture of things that only act on a certain number of qubits. And that's not the most general thing that could happen to n qubits. So that's enough of a restriction that we'll already be able to do very interesting stuff. And in fact, allowing this as opposed to this, is not going to change anything about quantum error correction. We'll see that in a little bit.
So you call it a T-qubit error, even though it's a probabilistic mixture.
Well, that's right. So the property that this has is that you know absolutely that whatever happens, only T qubits have been changed. Kind of, if you condition on kind of the information that the environment has about what it did. Yeah?
I'm wondering, just take that in a more mathematically concise way, would it mean that if you took one term with a specific T qubits that have a specific n
minus T qubits? You mean one term in this convex combination?
Yeah. The first definition. You mean if you took the partial trace and left just the n minus t qubits, they should be the same state?
Yeah. So it's the identity map on those n minus t qubits. That's the mathematical version of what I said here. Yeah.
Does the anything include the identity as well?
Yeah, sure. So that would be kind of a trivial t qubit error. So there'll be some things where I'm making that distinction, but for the purpose of the definition, we'll allow that.
Okay, so the convex combination could have some terms that are less than T.
Yeah. Okay, good. So now let's define something that's kind of similar but different. So this is going to be called the T-qubit erasure. Sometimes an erasure error, sometimes an erasure channel. Again, kind of indistinguishable. And so it's very similar to this, except that there's some extra information that you get out. So the channel produces an extra register. And that extra register is going to tell you which of the T qubits were affected. So the subtle distinction, maybe more obvious how that differs from this part of the definition, where, so in this case, you know, it could be a mixture of things acting on different sets of qubits. They always have to be T. And so in that case, this one, you might be confused because you don't know where they're acting. But in this case, you do know where they're acting. You don't know ahead of time which ones they're going to act on, but afterwards, you know which ones actually got changed. But we don't get any other information. We don't know what happened to the ones that were shaped. Only which ones were shaped. So the subtlety is that in this top part of the definition, I'm assuming that I don't actually know what those T qubits are. So it's kind of shady. But it's in the same way that I don't know what it's doing to those bad T qubits. I don't know which ones are being affected either. So there's kind of some uncertainty that might be randomness in the channel, and some uncertainty that's because I don't know what it's about. Yeah?
And why is it erasure?
Why is it erasure? Well, okay, so one way you could have this channel is if you send, say, a bunch of qubits through a channel, like maybe a bunch of photons, and some of them don't arrive. They get lost along the way. So in that case, well, you could kind of stick in some extra qubits to replace extra photons to replace the ones that were lost. But the state of them would have to be unrelated to the state that went in, because you don't have any record of what they are. So kind of the original ones have been erased, and they've been replaced by the standard photon that you're sticking in. But you do know which ones didn't arrive, because they had a specific place in time, for instance. But you just don't know what the original state was. Okay? So again, this is the type of thing that can be fairly common experimentally. Yeah?
So for a d-qubit error, why wouldn't one redefine it as an S whose Gauss operators were linear combinations of tensor products of Pauli matrices, which
one? Yeah, you can do that. You can do that.
That would be
the definition is slightly different. Mm-hmm. But again, in terms of quantum error correction, it doesn't matter. So I go with this because it's simpler. It's anyway more intuitive. Whereas that one is kind of weird. Yeah.
So Daniel, how exactly do we mean by saying that the channel could use an extra register that which tells?
No. So it produces. So this is a case where the output Hilbert space is different from the input Hilbert space. Okay, so maybe this is not the right best way to write it. Instead, you might think of it as you put in h1 through hn, and you get a h1 through hn and some additional hn plus 1. And hn plus 1 is, log of n choose t qubits that tells you which t were affected. And again, those t, might have been the identity. Right, so again, that's like the case here. So it might have been that it was actually fewer than t qubits. But then the channel is allowed to give you some extra qubits to fill out the full set of t that were erased. Okay. Sometimes in this channel you'll have the extra information that you actually know it was less than, but you won't think about that case. Okay? Other questions? Okay, so in that case, I want to say one more thing about errors before moving on to error correction. And that's, well, why do we consider this t-qubit error? I mean, is that ever going to happen in reality, that either we have, that we know that we have at most t-qubits, but anything could happen to them? Well, no, of course, we don't ever really know that. But the thing is that it's very closely related to these types of independent errors. So why is that? Well, so what we can do is consider, say, the depolarizing channel. Depolarizing. And if you've forgotten what it is, it's up there. So this is the ones where we have probably 1 minus p of doing nothing, and probably p of doing a random Pauli error. And we're going to do this independently. On n qubits. Well, what do we get there? Well, so you have this matrix which is this operation polarizing with probability p, acting n times. And what are we going to get out? Well, it's not exactly binomial expansion, but a non-commutative binomial expansion. So we have the one term is 1 minus p to the n, where we have nothing happening. And then we have a term that looks like this, 1 minus p to the n minus 1 times p. And that's all the things that have 1 Pauli error. So in other words, it's x1 plus x2, etc. zone. And of course, we have to consider y and z as well. And then, well, it doesn't end there. Of course, we have 1 minus p to the n minus 2 p squared times the sum of the thing with two poly errors. And when I say two polys, I mean on different qubits. And, well, and so on. So, of course, somewhere in the middle here we have 1 minus p to the n minus t p to the t with t poly errors. Okay? And the point here is that when p is small, this is going to be dominated by the terms that have a relatively small value of t. And when we do that, we're going to have some error that's smaller than p to the t. Okay? Everyone see that? And what's left over is a t qubit error. And in fact, it wasn't really dependent on us doing the depolarizing capital. It's just easy to write down the depolarizing capital. So, in fact, if you have any independent channel, and each of these SIs is near the identity, well, then you're going to have something similar. So the output state of this channel will have very high fidelity of something off from 1 by something of order p to the t plus 1. Actually, let me change the notation, make that f to the t plus 1. Has fidelity 1 minus of f to the t plus 1 to a t qubit error channel. Where the fidelity between each individual channel's input and output is greater than or equal to 1 minus f. So I confess I haven't actually calculated the exact formula. So it may be that with fidelity there's some weird square root or something that appears here. But you can go to other measures. And there's a very nice measure called the Diamond norm that tells about distance on superoperators. And for the Diamond norm, this is the equivalent thing of this is very trivial to prove. Yeah.
So
what's changed
from p to f? Aren't they just the same?
Well, yeah, but p is like a probability and f is like a fidelity. So for the general channel, probability is not necessarily involved, right? Because this could even be a unit term.
Sorry, I thought the expression 1 minus order f to p plus 1 is the fidelity.
Isn't that circular? Yeah, so this is the fidelity. But the point is f is the, is, well, okay. F is the infidelity of the individual terms in this tensor product.
What is fidelity?
Oh, so fidelity, it doesn't really matter. like I said, since I didn't even calculate it myself. But fidelity is just some measure of how close two states are. So for pure states, it just turns out to be, well, there's different definitions, but it turns out to be the inner product between them. So if they're the same, they have inner product 1. And if they're very close, then they have inner product close to 1. If they're orthogonal states, then they have inner product 0. So fidelity is 0. So if you convert those to density matrices, you'll get the same value. And there's some way to extend this to general density matrices. So it's basically, it's just some measure of how close two states are. With 1 if they're the same, and 0 if they're
just
totally different.
Choice of norm of the difference?
Yeah, basically. I mean, this, since it's 1 when they're the same, it's not actually a norm, but it's related. Okay. Other questions?
And what's T in the statement of the theorem?
T. Oh, so if T is anything, but the point is that this is where it appears,
okay,
over here. So the point is if you go to more errors, you'll get even better fidelity to the actual time. Okay. And so this theorem is where we're really using the full power of this t-qubit error time, because we don't have to know really very much about what these SIs are. And this is still true. But we don't have to know anything, and this is still true. And the point is that if we don't know anything, then we really don't know what this t-qubit error time is going to be. I don't know if you can get this completely general t-qubit error this way. But certainly you can get a huge variety of things. No, in fact, actually, you can't get the most general thing. You can't get anything that entangles the separate things. But nevertheless, you can get lots of different things. Okay? Other questions? Okay. So in that case, we're ready to move on to actual error correction. Okay. Okay. So quantum error correction. What is it? Well, okay. First, let's talk about classical error correction. Classical error correction is a very well-developed theory, but for the purposes of this lecture, I only need to consider one very simple code just to kind of motivate things. And that's the repetition code. So what's the repetition code? Well, it's the most obvious possible thing you can do. Take a 0 and encode it as 3 zeros, and a 1 and encode it as 3 ones. Of course, if you're really paranoid, you might encode it as 5 or 7 or 9 ones. But let's just stick with 3 if you want. Okay? And then you send this through your channel, and maybe it undergoes some bit flips. And you'll see something out at the end. Well, suppose you see something like this. Well, what did that come from? Probably that came from a 0, right? Because, again, by the same logic as in the quantum case, if the probability of error is small, it's more likely that only one bit flipped than that two bits flipped. And to get to here from here, you need to flip two bits, whereas from here to here, you only need one. So what we do is we take the majority. And get back to where we started. Okay, very simple. So why can't we do the same thing quantum mechanically? Right? You might say, well, okay, so let's take a quantum state. And if you want to make a quantum error correcting code, we'll make 3 copies of it. And then we'll take the majority of them. We'll see which one has been changed. And we'll throw it out and replace it by another copy of the state. So what's wrong with that? No cloning theorem, right? So there's this general no cloning theorem. That says we can't make copies of states. Of quantum states. there's less more space. Okay. So, and actually, if you think about classical error correction, it seems like a real problem. Because the way classical error correction works is it adds redundancy to the state. It adds extra bits that are, in some sense, generalizations of this repetition thing. Maybe very sophisticated generalizations. But you think that somehow you have to replicate the information in various places so that it won't be lost when the errors occur. So this might seem like a real problem for quantum error correction. But let's say we can somehow get around that. Well, even then, we're not done. Because, well, let's think about the way this classical error correction procedure works. But what we do, we said we look at the state, and we see which of the bits is different. Well, clearly there's something dangerous there, right? Because we have quantum superpositions here that we want to protect. And if you look at a quantum superposition, we'll collapse it. It won't be a superposition anymore. And what's the point of having a quantum state if you can't have superpositions? So that's the second problem. Third problem. Well, okay, again, suppose we solve these first two problems. But even so, things are going to be certainly much more complicated, maybe even impossible, if much more complicated than classical error correction. Because we don't have to consider, classically, we only had to worry about bit flips. But quantum mechanically, we have all these other kinds of errors we have to worry about. So for instance, we have those Pauli errors over on the left. We have bit flips and phase flips and these Y that are simultaneous bit and phase flips. So we need to do more than just bit flips. But also these others. And of course, that's not the end of it. You might hope to correct these errors, and it's only a finite list after all. But really, there's an infinite list of possible errors, right? We have these continuous rotations, for instance. Or we have errors like those up there that take a pure state and generate a mixed state out of it, decoherent errors. How do you handle those? So really, there's an infinite list of errors that we have to correct. How can we possibly do that if we only want to work with a finite number of qubits? It seems like it would be a nice property for a quantum error correcting code to have. Okay. So at this point, things might look pretty hopeless. But I guess you can probably guess that they're not, in fact, hopeless, or the course would have to end here. So we can deal with all of these problems, but let's start at the top. Let's just deal with them one by one for the moment. I think I can get rid of these.
So, Daniel, when you say decoherence, you mean something other than an error?
No, I mean just one of these errors that is taking pure states to mixed states. So the term is used in some different ways. Some people use it just to talk about dephasing. Some use decoherence to talk about any error that's a combination of has multiple cross operators. So anything that's not unitary. But for the purpose of this problem, it doesn't really matter how you define it. It's just something that you have to worry about. Okay, so first problem. So really, when we think about it, what's wrong with a repetition code, quantum mechanically? Suppose we just want to correct bit flip errors, right? We're just starting at the top. We're not trying to deal with all these other kinds of errors. So just try to correct bit flip errors on a quantum state and see if we can do that. So it seems like we should be able to use the repetition code to do that, right? But where's the no-cloning theorem? Well, okay, so what if we do just use the repetition code? So let's encode our 0 as 3 zeros, and we'll put just kets around them to indicate that it's now a quantum state. And the 1 will be 3 ones. I've now introduced a little bit of notation. I'll put these lines over something to say that it's an encoded state. So this is... Sometimes I call it encoded state, sometimes I'll call it logical state. So we can do that, and then by linearity, we can see that if we take a superposition, alpha 0 plus beta 1, so this is the encoded alpha 0 plus beta 1 state, then we should get alpha times this plus beta times this. So what about the no-cloning theorem? Well, this is not equal to 3 copies of the original state. As you'll see if you just try to write this out. This thing has cubic terms in alpha and beta, whereas this is just linear. And that's why this is not allowed and this is. Quantum mechanics is linear, so cubic terms you can't get, linear terms you can. Okay? So what we've done with this encoding is we've made an entangled state instead of 3 copies of the state. Okay? So that's going to be our general strategy. So that's how we avoid this no-cloning problem. We make entangled states instead of copies. So this is, in some sense, copying, but it's only copying in one basis, and that's allowed. What you're not allowed to do is copy the general superposition. Okay? Everyone understand that? Okay. And so now we think this thing should be able to correct bit flip errors. But really, if we're protecting a qubit, we'd like to do it without ruining superpositions. That's our problem number 2. So how are we going to do that? I mean, if we were to look at this to try to measure it, see if it were, 0, 1, 0, a wrong state, then that would collapse superposition. So we have to be careful. So let's now think a little bit more, in this classical case, how we actually figure out what the error is. So what we actually do, classically, of course, it's convenient to look at all the bits. But really, all we need to know is which one is different. And if we can do that without figuring out whether it's an encoded 0 or an encoded 1, we won't collapse the superposition. And so that's going to be the key to answering question number 2. So let's think about that a little more carefully. So what we're going to do is this. So we'll take our 3 qubits, which are encoded in this quantum version of the repetition code. And we want to figure out which of those, we're going to assume that there's just one error, and we're going to try to figure out which one of those three qubits is different from the other two. So how do we do that? Well, suppose we're just two qubits. How do we tell whether they're different from each other? Well, we take the XOR. That's something pretty straightforward. So what we can do is we can add some extra qubits down here and take a controlled knot from here to here and another one from here to here. Okay? And then if you measure this, this measured qubit will tell us if these are the same or different, right? Because if they're both zero, nothing happens down here. If they're both one, it gets flipped twice. So again, it stays at zero. Whereas if they're different, this only gets flipped once. Right? This is taking the parity of those two qubits. Everyone see that? Okay. And then, well, that tells us whether the first two are the same or different. But we should also figure out whether the second two are the same or different. So we'll do the same thing with another qubit. Okay? So these extra qubits that we're adding here are called ancillas. And the classical bits that we get out of this procedure are known as the error syndrome. And I claim that this error syndrome is enough to figure out which error occurred, so where the bit flip is. So why is that? Let's consider the four possibilities here. So if the error syndrome is 0, 0, so that means the first two bits are the same and the second two bits are the same. So what error was there then? Somebody said something, but I couldn't hear.
Is that the identity?
The identity, right? Because if the first two are the same and the second two are the same, then all three are the same. So we'll assume that there's no error. Yeah, so of course there could have been a bit flip on all three of the qubits. But let's restrict to the case where we just have one qubit error, so only one qubit can fail. And we'll deduce our quantum error correction code based on that. So this is just going to be a general property of quantum error correction. We have to make some limitation on the possible errors that we're trying to correct. And of course, again, the motivation for picking one qubit errors is that stuff up there, right? That we can consider this as the kind of the high probability part of a general independent error. That's one possible motivation. Okay, so let's go on. So that's the case where there's no errors. What about if we have the error syndrome 0, 1. So the first two bits are the same, and the second two are different. What's the error then? Say it loud. Can you hear it? The third qubit, right? Because the second and third are different, so one of them must have been changed. But the second and first are the same, so neither of them was changed. So we know it has to be the third qubit. And similarly, we can look at the case 1, 0. And say, well, the first two are different, the second two are the same. So it must be the first one that's the oddball. And in the case of 1, 1, of course, it's the second qubit. Right? So this error syndrome is telling us which error occurred. But the important thing to notice is that it doesn't matter at all what the encoded qubit was. This is the same. This error syndrome is giving us the same information, whether we have the encoded 0 or the encoded 1. And therefore, it also works if we have alpha 0 plus beta 1 encoded. So that's the solution to the second problem. The solution is that we're going to measure the error and not the data. Okay. So we solved problems 1 and 2. So problem 3 is going to take us a little bit longer. So far we said how to correct just x errors. So now let's try to change things up and instead try to correct just z errors, right? Rather than leaping all the way to trying to correct everything. So how do we do that? Well, mathematically, the phase flip and the bit flip look really very similar. And in fact, more than that, they're similar in a very concrete way. The z error is just the bit flip error in a different basis. So that's our solution, is we're going to look at a different basis. We'll define this basis plus and minus, with plus being 0 plus 1, and minus being 0 minus 1. And then z acting on these basis states, well, z on plus, so z, remember, takes 0 to 0 and 1 to minus 1. So it takes 0 plus 1 to 0 minus 1, plus to minus. And z acting on minus gives us a plus. So in other words, z acts like the bit flip. For this plus and minus basis. Okay? Yeah?
In this previous case, could you just spell out how... So we know where the error occurred, but how do we know which error it was? Like, how do we know where...
So in this previous case, we're assuming that we just have bit flip errors.
Okay.
And that we just have, at most, one bit flip error. So all we have to distinguish is between those four possibilities of no error, or the bit flip is on the first, the second, or the third qubit.
And then we measure the original state?
We don't want to do that, because that would just spread superposition. We only measure those ancilla qubits, and that's enough to tell us where the error is. And then we can correct it by, since it's an x, you know, unitary operation. So we can just, once we know where it is, we can easily invert it. Yeah, I guess I should have said that. Okay? So for z, we're going to do the same thing, but in this different basis, the plus minus basis. So what we're going to do, for instance, we can encode the 0 as 3 plus states, and the 1 as 3 minus states. And again, if you have a superposition, alpha 0 plus beta 1, that's... the superposition of those two. So again, we're avoiding no clinic here. So maybe it's worth saying at this point that you don't really have to restrict to just pure states. All of this is actually going to work automatically the same way if we have part of an entangled state. So for instance, let's assume for the moment that we have a bunch of qubits that are perfect, and then one qubit that we have to worry about these errors on. So, and there might be the state of our system might be an entangled state between these two separate things. And so by defining these basis states, 0 and 1, again, by linearity, you can look at the basis states for the entangled system, and they'll go right over. So this kind of encoding, here, maybe I could write that explicitly. So if we have some entangled state, the most general entangled state between this qubit and the rest of our system could look like this. So we could have something of this form. Right? And this would get encoded then just like this. Okay. Of course, in real life, this phi 0 and phi 1 aren't going to be immune from errors either. But they can then be encoded using some different quantum error correction. And we're just focusing on this one at the moment because that's the one we're interested in. Okay? And all that business about measuring the error and not the data applies just the same when it's the state is part of an entangled state rather than a superposition here. So in fact, it's generally true that correcting superpositions is really enough for quantum error correction, at least when you're talking about perfect quantum error correction, like you argue. Okay? Okay, so anyway, so now we're going to do the same thing with this other basis that we did before, except, of course, we have to do it in the other basis. So what we're going to do is we're going to take 3 qubits. We'll have, again, our encoded state. So, but now we don't want to check if they're all 3 of these are 0 or all 3 are 1. So, well, again, we'll add an ancilla. And we're going to use that ancilla to measure the error syndrome. But now we don't want to check, say, if the first two are both 0 or both 1. We want to check if they're both plus or both minus. We want to compare the phases. So how are we going to do that? Well, we're going to make these ancillas into the plus state and do controlled knots in the other way. Okay? And the reason that works is, well, if you take a bit flip on a plus state, it doesn't do anything, right? 0 plus 1 becomes 0 plus 1. And if you do a bit flip on a minus state, well, you get a minus sign. 0 minus 1 becomes 1 minus 0, which is minus the original thing. So if these are both plus, then these two things do nothing. And if these are both minus, well, these two things give us 2 phase flips down here. Well, these two things give us 2 phase flips. Let's not worry about where. And those phase flips will cancel out. Okay. On the other hand, if one of these is a plus and one of these is a minus, then we only get 1 phase flip. And so now we have to worry about the fact that these are conditional operations. So what happens down here? Well, we have plus. So if it's 0, so this is 0 plus 1. So if it's 0, we don't do anything no matter what. So it always stays 0. And 1, well, we do these 2 bit flips. Right? And those 2 bit flips give us a plus sign if these are the same in this basis, and a minus sign if they're opposite in this basis. Okay? So what happens is if we have a 0 down here, nothing happens always. If you have a 1, it stays 1 if they're the same, and it goes to minus 1 if they're different. So in other words, this plus goes to a minus if these are different, and it stays a plus if they're the same. So what we're going to do is, well, okay, and then we're going to do the same thing for the second and the third qubits. And then before we measure, we do the Hadamard transform. Okay, and the Hadamard transform will transform us from this basis back into the usual 0, 1 basis. So this is basically just measuring in the plus minus basis. Okay? So I don't know, if that went too fast, you can do it again yourself. This is a very simple circuit. And work out what happens. And you'll see that this thing is exactly the same as that thing, but in this plus or minus basis. So similarly, this is telling us which of these 3 qubits is different in this basis. So it's comparing it with the signs. Okay? Okay, so that's conveniently taken us to exactly 5. Well, actually, that clock is fast, so it's almost 5. So maybe this is a good time to stop. We'll take a 5-minute break. and then resume with an actual quantum error correcting code that can correct not just bit flips or face flips, but both at once.